Welcome to another Good Areas Live podcast. This is The Wagon. We are the show where we answer your questions on the great game. You can do that if you're watching along live by doing a super chat on YouTube. I think we're doing a different time than normal, so might be different super chatters. I don't know. Feel free. But if not, the other way of doing it, of course, is on Patreon. So if you go to Good Areas podcast on Patreon, you can support us there. And I think it's from the first class and above level. Not only do you get access to the Discord and everything else, but you get the ability to ask questions on this show, like Sashimi has said. Well, has sent. Whatever, Sashimi. Should India now drop Jadeja as their difficult tours are over and have some easy matches at home? It would be the perfect time for a full reset and to groom Akshar as the next Jadeja. Or do you think all of Washington, Jadeja, Akshar and Kuldeep play together? A lot of it is, I'm not a big fan of just dropping people. India made a mistake by kind of forcing Ashwin's hand a little bit, right? Not because he would have played an awful lot in this series, but you're losing out on experience, knowledge, all these sorts of things when you move players on too drastically. And because everyone had left, they suddenly left a bit of a hole, right? If Jadeja could play for another 3 or 4 years, right? So why would you get rid of him now or push him to a point where he may not want to play? He should still be a pretty good cricketer until his fingers and arm go, right? You know, he's bad. If he can't bowl, then probably his batting isn't as useful to you. But while he can bowl, he can be. So you have a conversation with him and you say, what about if you play every set? You know, you start doing sort of a Jimmy Anderson treatment. He might just say, if that's how you're going to be, I don't want to play. Or he might be like, great. You know, I've had niggles my whole career. Thank you very much. You know, you never know with those sorts of things. So it's always better to have the conversation. That's what I would do. You know, and you'll hear me say that a lot on this channel because I think it's one thing that teams are not particularly good at. Or boards, maybe. Ellie says, what is the hype looking around the 100 this year? I've been 25, to, you know, I wanted to make t-shirts that said I survived 25. But so I haven't really thought much about the 100. A couple of my friends started sending me messages recently, but I haven't seen a lot of hype as far as from what I can tell from here. Mob says, how do you evaluate Sai Sudarshan's progress in England? And do you think the BCCI see him the same way you do? I don't really know how they see him at the moment. I think everyone knows that he could be a very good test batter, but maybe like a better version of... No, actually, Zach Roll is the wrong player. I wonder who the right player would be for him. Yeah, that's actually an interesting one. I wonder who the sort of player... You know, there's a part of me that thinks Sai Sudarshan could be like a Greg Blewett, where there's some sort of flaw, Owen Morgan maybe. Obviously, there are very talented players, but is there some sort of limitation in the sort of first-class game that gets picked up that white ball cricket doesn't, which is why he's averaging a little bit more, a little bit less in first-class cricket. So I wonder if that's the case. He's still a really good player. I didn't see anything there that told me that he can't be a test player or anything like that. But I'm still interested. I still just want to see him make consistent runs. And once he starts to make consistent runs, obviously things will change. Cam says, so much respect for Gill and Jaiswal for not wearing a beard like every other Indian player in the last few years that have copied Kohli. Noting that they're probably too young anyway. Well, Cam, remember, not all people can grow beards. I can't grow a beard, right? Like, I get a nice sort of even fuzz on my face, but I can't grow a beard, so, you know, maybe it's that as well. But in Jaiswal's case, it might also be that he's basically still 8, isn't he? Neil says, what do you think has led to Test cricket between the big three actually growing in popularity over the past decade? Death of bilateral ODIs, India travelling well, more exciting cricket, went to all 5 Tests this summer, and you can be led to believe that things are better than they have been in a while. It certainly are for the best big three teams. They're all good. It's probably a big part of it. One day cricket in Asia probably took... One day cricket in Australia took a hit early, which is why the Tri series disappeared, right? That was kind of followed by English crowds a little bit. When T20 cricket came, it didn't really attack Test cricket the way that some people thought it would. It attacked one day cricket, which is more what I was saying back originally, which was I thought that was the... That had no reason to exist anymore. once T20 came along. So I think those things have all played a part. India being good has certainly played a part, but all three have been either good or interesting at different times. I think in Test cricket fans are more pure in general, in that the game of cricket matters to them more than some of the other outside parts, right? Not that they're any more special than any other cricket fans. Like, I don't care if T20 is your favourite format or whatever, but there is probably an element of Test cricket fans who are maybe more interested in how things are done and the technical side of things and everything else. Test cricket's always been at a bit of a distance. And now with cameras and everything else, I think there's a bit of an upsurge. There's an upsurge even in some of the other countries. It's just that they can't make money off it, right? Whereas these countries can. But yeah, so I would say that it's probably a combination of that. I honestly think that Virat Kohli plays a big part in this, because he suddenly decides that Test cricket, well, not suddenly, but he, MS Dhoni didn't grow up thinking about Test cricket the way that Virat Kohli did, right? That's not having a go at him, because everyone thinks differently about these sorts of things. I remember talking to Tamal Mills once, and he was like, that just wasn't that big a thing. So to me, which one can I retire? Which one can I make more money off? Which one am I better at? You know, and he went with the one that he thought he could have the better career at. That wasn't the way that players used to feel. And I think with Virat, you know, it's very clear, and he made it clear all the way through his career, and then also when he won the IPO, that Test cricket is the thing that matters the most to him. That team played like that as well. That hasn't really disappeared in Australia, even though we've seen more of a freelance cricket culture coming through. So I think there's probably a multitude of factors. Baseball probably helps as well. Like, wasn't the English Test cricket was dying, but it's going to be talked about more because A, they're winning more, and B, it's more entertaining. Ali says, does Test cricket have a profitable future with just the big three playing five Test series, or is that always going to start losing money soon with its repetitiveness? No, it shouldn't. It shouldn't lose money for a while. I mean, I don't know what will happen in 15 to 20 years, but in the short term, I don't think that's as much of a problem. I mean, if you were the NBA, Ali, and you could sort of make sure that the Lakers and the Celtics made all the finals with occasional, Warriors and Knicks and Bulls, maybe, would they be the other one that you would have there? That is kind of your dream, right? You know, it's the same with the Champions League. The whole idea of the Champions League at one stage was almost to get rid of all the fairy tale teams. It might be slightly more dull, but it's kind of also how sports end up a little bit anyway, right? Like, it's not that much different than Mumbai Indians, KKR, and CSK winning like the majority of the trophies. So that generally happens in sport one way or another anyway. Aravind says, I'll preface this by saying I completely agree with you that nationalistic notions are nonsense, and having lived around the world, I'm matured enough to know it's all misguided. However, I still care about the Indian cricket team deeply, to the point that sometimes it would just be easier and less stressful if I could watch from a more neutral perspective. Maybe there's something to do with as a kid growing up, watching the team, including Sachin in the 90s. Can't seem to let that aspect go. When did you become side agnostic? I've talked about this quite a bit before, Aravind. I'm not side agnostic, right? It's just that my team is the Victorian Bushrangers, and so you guys don't see it. So there is a big part of that. I obviously don't believe in nationalism. I think it's an absolute joke. And, you know, you hear the Gambia, conversation. I played club cricket with guys I played club cricket with a guy who fielded short leg without a helmet to my bowling, got whacked in the head, lost consciousness, was being carried from the field, regained consciousness, and tried to fight his way back onto the field, right? He could have had a skull fracture, right? He definitely had concussion. And so I know that's not how competitive people go. The biggest thing for me is just that I think cricket has played as big a part in my life as Australia has. So why would I put Australian cricket above cricket? Like, it doesn't, to me, just doesn't make any sense. I would be bored if I just had to watch the Australian cricket team play over and over again. Not that they're not great, not that I haven't celebrated their victories, not that, you know, it's certainly something that I enjoyed when I was younger, but it would be weird to me. Like, if Australia didn't play cricket anymore, I would still follow cricket. So I think that's the direction that I come from, Aravind. Ben says, who is the greatest batter, not test batter, as per the book, of all time, Bradman or Grace? I wonder if Bradman is the best speaker of the language Grace invented. It's a tough one. You'd have to do a big deep dive. But if you're saying best batter of all time, I think Sachin comes back into that conversation as well because of ODI cricket, right? He's top four test and top four ODI. So I think he has to come back into that quite dramatically. But yeah, I don't think it's Sachin. I don't think Sachin goes above Bradman or Grace, but I think he should be in this conversation. Grace is interesting. I'd have to go back through the full numbers. I know some of them off the top of my head, but I'd have to go back through, and I don't know if me and Byron can ever do this, but have a look at what he would have, what his kind of match factor, an era factor would have been for first-class cricket. And considering that it's only first-class cricket, although obviously it was the best cricket being played in the world at that time, but it's only first-class cricket. Like, he has to have numbers that are more impressive than Bradman. He's a weird player, Grace, because he's a combination of Wilt Chamberlain and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So Wilt Chamberlain has that. Like, there are going to be years that Grace's numbers are going to look, you know, there's the year where he makes more first-class hundreds than the rest of first-class cricket combined, right? Like, that's a Wilt Chamberlain level number. But he also has the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar longevity, right? What is it? 35 years? It's probably longer than that. Like, he's really good for over 30 years in professional batting. He's above average for over 35 years of his life. And there just aren't athletes that do that all that often. And no one else did that in his era, right? Like, he stands out amongst his era, let alone everything else. But yeah, I'd probably have to really go into his first class numbers. So because I haven't done that to the level that I have with Bradman or Tendulkar, right? It's probably still Bradman, but I'm sure, I think you can make a case for all three of them to be the greatest batter of all time. I think you can. It might still end up being Bradman just because Bradman, right? But maybe when you really go into Sachin's ODI numbers and Grace's first class numbers, maybe you come out the other side feeling a little different. James says, baseball nerds have a concept called the Hall of Very Good. An honor we might bestow on a player who deserves to be remembered, but is believed to fall short of Hall of Fame stature. What do you think of this Hall of Very Good 90 players? Taylor, Atherton, Richie Richardson, Fleming, Sourav, Jimmy, Parore, Merv Hughes, Heastreek, Andy Carrick, Harbhajan Singh. I mean, Harbhajan Singh is probably more of a 2000s, but the rest of them, yeah, I get what you're saying. I think that's probably fair. Mark Taylor and Jimmy Adams, you might even throw Richie Richards into this. At certain times, it looked like they were going to be Hall of Fame players, and just for a multitude of reasons, all three of them just sort of fell off completely. I don't think you would have said that with Fleming or Ganguly. Is Ian Healy not probably above Parore? Or what's his name? The guy that ended up running the ICC? I might have them ahead of Parore. Merv Hughes is a really interesting one, because what would his bowling average be? Would Merv Hughes' bowling average be roughly what Starks is? God, I forgot you have to write everything very specifically into Google now. Remember when Google used to work? Where are we here? It's literally come up with batting average twice. Bowling average 28. Yeah. And yet not really remembered as a fantastic bowler. It's not that much of a different career than Starks. I wonder how many years they both will play. Starks should play for longer though, shouldn't he? Merv Hughes is just really underrated because he was a ridiculous looking and acting human being. I think Heastreek's an interesting one as well, because if you factor in the batting, but yeah, it's a very good list, this. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, and I have heard that concept before. Aravind says, if you don't mind me asking, I'm curious to know how you ended up getting to know Dravid so well. Was it just a case of being on tour together and fellow cricket nerds recognizing each other and just getting on? I remember you had him on for Polite Inquiries and later Death of a Gentleman. Yeah, was he on Death of a Gentleman? He might have been. I think Death of a Gentleman was the first time I met him. And he was obviously still playing then, wasn't he? Yeah, so we must have been, was it 2012? 2011. No, it was 11, 12, yeah. I think that's the first time I met him. I can't remember if I interviewed him or Sam did. No, it was me. I interviewed him. And I didn't realize that he'd been reading some of my stuff. So we just started chatting about that a little bit, like, especially when we're waiting for things to, we must have got him on an off day. I know we were in the park outside the Wacker. I remember that. And I used to have, I think, a framed photo of me interviewing him somewhere. I don't know where that's gone. Anyway, that was certainly when I first met him. Then we worked together with Polite Inquiries. Then we, you know, chatted a few times. I wouldn't say we're like best friends or anything, but yeah, it's really interesting that there's a couple of guys in this game, like Raoul Dravid. I put someone like Rob Smythe, the former Guardian writer who writes, I think he has a Substack now, probably, and a podcast and everything else. Probably put Smythe on that. There's a guy called Christian Ryan in Melbourne. I haven't spent like ages with these guys, but if you were around us, you would think that we are best friends and we just have a natural chemistry and the conversations do go long. So Dravid is just one of those people that when we start to chat, like we were chatting at one of, I can't remember if it was an under 19, no, it was a India A tour and he was at Beckenham. And like once we, you know, we're talking 2 hour discussions where we're just talking, you know, about cricket and nonsense, but it's sort of once we start to chat, that's kind of what happens, right? And everyone else sort of disappears. I think that's just a connection that you just get with people, right? Like, so yeah, Polite Inquiries is probably where I got to know him. And then he was around with Crick Info quite a bit at that point. And, you know, a couple of dinners, a couple of nights out, you know, all that sort of stuff. If I'm remembering back well enough. Lemon says, as wickets around the world become more difficult to bat on in some places, Australia, India, etc., while England is ultra flat, will we see a match factor or something similar become a more popular tool for batters? I mean, it should have always been popular, Lemon. Just we didn't know to look for it, I suppose, would be the best point. It's already being used quite a bit. And I know England have, you know, there's the CricViz version of it as well, if you have access to that, which is not match factor, but, you know, expected average. But yeah, I think, you know, match factor, era factor, all these things definitely need to be looked at when you're looking at players. And I think going ahead in the future, you're right, we will see more of them. There are multiple different versions. Those are just some of the ones that we use here. But yeah, I do believe that. All right, quick break here. And then as we come back, as we do something, there'll be more of this thing right here. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting. PJ says, Jackson Bird, was he unlucky, not good enough, injured, or just competing for a tough spot? It would be 39 at the end of the year, 500 first-class wickets of 24. He bowled on a couple of flat wickets, is my memory of someone who didn't play a lot of test matches. But where does he fit into this side? Jackson Bird is basically competing in, over the last, what, 5 or 6 years with Hazelwood and Boland. Cummins comes in as well. I think once Pattinson, Stark, Cummins and Hazelwood, once any three of those guys came in, anyone else is going to be the backup. Like Michael Nisa is a fantastic bowler. Did Chris Tremaine play any test matches? I think he did, didn't he? Chris Tremaine? God, I honestly don't even understand how Google works anymore. Chris Tremaine. Let's have a look. He played a couple of test matches. Most of these guys, Ezekiel's come in with a note that he hasn't. Yeah, but what do you want me to say on air, right? When it's keep or chuck, right? Thumbs up or thumbs down would have been the correct way. Yeah, keep. My God. Yeah, so guys like Chris Tremaine, all those guys would have bowled a lot more in tests. Trent Copeland probably would have played more. But what do you do when you have four generational talents, three of which make it, right? Like, if if, I don't know, Hazelwood or Cummins had gone, or Stark had gone the Pattinson way, there would have been a lot more opportunities for a lot more bowlers. I'm not sure that Jackson Bird's would have had a... I think he's probably more of a first-class bowler who would have been a handy backup. Maybe it would have been like a late career Siddle at times, but they just didn't need him, right? They just don't need it. A person says, sorry if this sounds dumb. Why did the West Indies and Pakistan do 3 matches in Florida and not like either make it a trilateral with USA or just play in the West Indies? If playing USA wouldn't make money or the board is incompetent, then why play in Florida and not like Barbados to begin with? I'm assuming there was some sort of sponsorship to hook up or somewhere where the money comes in would be my guess. You'd have to look at the people who were setting that up and why it was being set up and everything else. But I don't know. It might be one for Peter Dallapena, that one. Adityan says, how do we end up with Impact outside off as not out for an LBW appeal? How would cricket have evolved if Impact outside off was decided to be out? I think it would limit the attractiveness of batting shots as much as anything. The attractiveness is maybe the wrong term, although that is what would happen. You would get more shots that are defensive because of this. Because more people wouldn't just put their foot outside the line and try and play an attacking shot anymore, because that can now be out. So it's like most of the laws, the reason that you can't get LBW for outside leg stump, right? For pitching outside leg is because that is how people would bowl over and over again. And we know that from limited times when things like that have been available, or even when you could have all the fielders down the leg side, right? When you could have as many fielders as you wanted behind square leg, it wasn't body line that finished that off. It was off spinners and in-swing bowlers. Everyone who got picked at around the world suddenly became an in-swing bowler, and they would pitch the ball in middle and leg and angle it down, trying to get you caught at their three leg slips. I think it's Peter May at the MCG. Have a look at that. It's terrible cricket, right? Because if you're bowling at off stump, you are bringing in, you can still hit the ball to the leg side and you can score on the off side and you can basically score anywhere. When you're bowling a foot down the leg side, you can't do that. This is one of those other situations that if you were to bring this in, it would actually change the dynamics of how batting goes. And I don't know how it would improve the game. Right, that's the point. Most of the changes we've made were to improve the game. Some of them are still wrong, like the front foot no ball law, but they are there to improve the game. How does this improve the game? If the ball's outside off stump and you can meet it outside off stump, we want you to play attacking shots, don't we? Aditya says, is Joe Root's peak now threatening to break into the all-time list, or is it already there? Over the past 4 years, he averages 55 plus with 20 hundreds. So the great peaks are like 65, 60, 75. So probably not. What is it? Smith, Ponting, Kohli. I'm just thinking of some good modern ones. I think they're well in advance of 55, right? Because 55 is, some players have that for a career number, right? Like I don't think that's all-time peaky. Kalas Sobers, there you go. Oh, Byron's in the chat. Didn't notice that. Sandeep says, while regional cricketing styles in India aren't as distinct as before, there's still a sense of local cricket culture like Mumbai's gritty batting or Hyderabad's elegant. What are some of the other microcultures or playing styles amongst Australian states? Queensland had the Queensland line. So they were the first ones to really bowl wide of the off stump and sort of do that. Obviously, famously, Western Australian players are much better at cuts and pulls and hooks because of the way that their wickets work. Victoria was the first one to have reverse swing because of the kind of pitches. Victoria has the back of the hand slower ball that really, I don't know who invented it, but Simon O'Donnell's the one who sort of brings it. But Simon O'Donnell, Ian Harvey, Merv Hughes has a version of it. When there are only like two or three other bowlers around the world bowling it consistently, it's mostly Victorians doing it. Players from New South Wales generally play spin a little bit better because their wickets are a little bit better. Those are sort of normal. I mean, everything eventually becomes more homogenous now because of YouTube and everything else, but conditions still play a part, right? There's a reason why in Sydney players use their feet more to spin, and that's because the wicket spun more. So you have to. Whereas maybe traditionally Western Australian players, I'm not, that's maybe not a good one, but Western Australian players may not have, right? Sandeep says, after the glory years of Sehwagology, which new cricket religion is likely to catch on? Pantology, Brookology, Duckadology, or something else? Late edit, Sirajology. I mean, Bazball is a cult on its own, Sandeep. So isn't that really? I mean, it's in the dictionary. It's kind of already on its way, I would have thought. Mob says, to what extent are all injuries in professional sport avoidable, inexcusable, treating players like collateral damage? I say this after New Zealand broke Will O'Rourke and Nate Smith in Bulawayo, while the Australian pace quartet just simmer along. There's a book, and I'm doing a podcast with a guy soon, a guy called Henry Abbott, who's released a book called Ballistic, which I have flicked through. I don't know where it is at the moment. It was on my desk. I have to find it at one stage. I think he would probably argue, and I haven't read his book yet, but I have talked to him for like 2 minutes at a conference. I think he would probably argue that they are avoidable and that we just don't know as much as we should know. But there is an element of, you know, twisting, things being missed, people having higher pain tolerance and everything else. Like, these are just things that happen. We have to accept that, you know, essentially what we do in sport is we pay for another person to use their body until their body doesn't work anymore, right? It's not always the case, obviously, but it certainly doesn't work the way it did when they first started. Ian says, from your time in the dressing room or speaking to players, what can those in the dressing room do to help on a day like day five at the Oval? England's top six are all out and connect no further apart. What do the top six do? To be honest, it is actually very, very similar, Ian, to club cricket. That's the one. Not everything is in professional cricket, but this is one where I remember talking to Gareth Batty about a collapse that he was involved in. And he was just like, he was explaining it. And I went, just to stop you, Bats, that's exactly how it happens in club cricket. And he's like, yeah, it's no different. That, you know, it's like the collapse sort of, or the pressure takes over. You don't want to give the guys in too much. I was wondering about the Atkinson thing of like, what would McCullum have told him? And I think the way that England sort of play their cricket now, I'm pretty sure that they wouldn't have been too much, right? And maybe a batter had something to say. But essentially, these are professional players, and even the batters are just going to have to go out there and do their thing. You don't want to give them too much information. You don't want their head spinning. You just want them to go out and watch the ball. And I suppose, understand that if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, right? Because that is also a very realistic option. KG says, you have mentioned there is no centralized statistics keeping in cricket. Sorry, I misread that for a moment. Which are the major companies for any international bilateral? Who decides where to get the stats for TV for? In the recent Global Super League, Rob Barron's decimals is played on the screen. What role would his company have played? Yeah, there is no official stats. TV company will just pay a statistician or Crickviz or Decimal to give them stats. That's all it is. The same with the league, right? There are some cricket boards now that I think have what they would consider official stats. I think Cricket Australia have something they call official stats within their system that they look at. But yes, essentially when it comes down to it, there is no like official stats keeper of cricket. The ACS is probably the closest that we have to that. I don't think they're funded by any cricket board. They might have some deals in place with cricket boards. I don't know enough about their inner workings, but it's possible. But yeah, they're not official themselves, but certainly closer than anyone else is by a distance. But yeah, that's just how it works really. And, these aren't leagues, so it's very different if you're the NBA, right, or you're Major League Baseball. Then it's a very different system. But the way that it's currently working at the moment, then this is how it is. Quick break. Back with more Wagon Wheel. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Sinoy says, thoughts on umpires having public stats on the accuracy of their decisions with the option of umpires being dropped during a series if they fall below a certain threshold. Yeah, I would never drop an umpire during a series. I think that just brings in conspiracies and everything else. But yes, we should have public access to stats and we should know about their decision making. It's a very normal thing. The ICC is very bad. I've done videos on this before, Sinoy. It's, yeah, we don't do it right in cricket. And it's pretty bad at the moment. It's pretty bad at the moment, I think. Yeah, it just doesn't work the way that it should. Umpires should be judged the same as everyone else is judged. I mean, that's just how professional sport works. Rob says, what are your thoughts on reducing the bat dimensions to even the balance between bat and ball and reduce mid-sits going for 4 or 6? I'm pretty happy with how the bat is. I think there's this thought at the moment. What has happened is the middle is bigger because of the way we make bats. It's not the size of the bats because the MCC stopped that 10 years ago, right? They changed the size of the bat. I thought they made a mistake at the time. I thought it went against the science that they even had available to them, but fine. They made that decision. We're still seeing more sixes now than before, right? We're seeing more sixes all the time. And as far as the balance between bat and ball, haven't bowlers been completely dominating batters in Test cricket for like more than a minute now? So I don't really understand. Are we just talking about T20 cricket, which is a sport that I would say the batters have been behind the game in and the bowlers have been the ones who have been winning it, and we should still be scoring faster in T20 cricket than we are. Aditya says, with Stark crossing 400 wickets in tests and given his record in white ball, do you think he has a case to be the second greatest left-arm bowler ever? Or do you still think Harath, Bolt, Davidson have better cases? Davidson's a weird one because he doesn't play enough, does he? Yeah, Bolt and Harath are interesting as well. I mean, Bolt and Harath are much better test bowlers than Stark. And Bolt isn't that far behind Stark in one-day cricket, but Stark's probably a much better T20 bowler. Certainly at his peak he was. Not now. Bolt's outlasted him, but Bolt never had a peak in T20 cricket like Stark did. Maybe no one. Maybe Bumrah and Malinga did. And Harath. Yeah. That's a good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer for you. James says, have you heard much about what the Indian team culture is like for Muslim players under Gambia? I would imagine that if it would be tough given he was a MP for an Islamophobic party, or is there a total separation for that when it comes to cricket? I haven't heard anything negative about this at all from inside the change room. It's always been a weird one for me of, you know, the Surrey change room was really diverse back in the, 90s to 2000s. And there's some hardline right-wingers, right, who have very stringent thoughts on things. And there were a lot of people from, you know, minority backgrounds, diverse backgrounds, and etc. And my understanding of that change room is people got on pretty well. It's a bit like an office, I suppose. So no, I haven't heard of anything from of that. Darren Lehman got penalized for calling Sri Lankans a certain name, and then years later picked Ashton Agar ahead of Nathan Lyon when he shouldn't have. And obviously Agar, his mother is Sri Lankan, I think I'm remembering correctly there. So there is an element of cricket's cricket. I'm not saying there aren't unconscious biases, because there are all the way through. That I think what you're looking for there is probably more to do with the fact that this is a very obvious one. But I suppose we won't know until they, you know, Gambia leaves or players start to leak it or leave the team themselves. But I certainly haven't heard anything. I don't think that's a thing. I don't know if it would make you comfortable, though, as one of those players. But as I can go through many situations where that has been the case, right? So, you know, Mark Boucher, was certainly someone that didn't always make everyone feel comfortable. And I think that's fairly well known now. So it's not as if what Gambier is doing is new or anything. There's a lot of right-wing lunatics. I wanted to do a documentary once behind the scenes on a county team, and Worcester was the team I wanted to do because Worcester had this incredible eclectic bunch of, I think they had a biblical literalist. They had a couple of like, you know, hardcore atheists. They had Moeen Ali, who I think was in the middle of like, quite, you know, really, really committing to Islam. There was someone else as well. They had all these, and I was just like, these are just different characters. That wasn't the religion side that I was as interested in, but these are just interesting characters. I just want to see these guys talking when they're relaxed, like in a change room. So it's probably, that's one of the things that cricket makes you do, I think. I mean, all sport, but cricket certainly is quite bizarre at times. So Shimi says, I'm sorry, I may not have made it clear last week. I didn't have a problem with 17 or 20 tests being arbitrary. My problem was that Root's team was judged harshly on a run of them on the most difficult schedules with four back-to-back series against India, Australia, World Test Champions, New Zealand. And you could argue that the 2021 Indian team was the best team in their history. And same could be said about New Zealand. Yeah, but what I'm saying is, Sashimi, is again, you were being arbitrary anyway, because you're still cherry-picking that period of time. Whereas actually, if you go back, they had over 3 years, they would have played a bunch of dud teams as well, right? And so is this team. So over a three-year period, this team is almost twice as good from a winning percentage. I might have dipped a little bit since you asked that last question, but from a win percentage compared to the previous team. Like, that last team was falling apart. Why do you think Joe Root didn't fight for it? It was falling apart. This is a better team. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Cam says, is the concept of retaining a trophy only a thing in the Ashes? There doesn't appear to be any mentions of retention following this drawn series, with India having won the last test series. Border Gavaskar was certainly one that people talk about retaining a little bit. It's more a thing in the Ashes than anything else. It's probably why I've kind of ignored it, Cam, if I'm being honest, as you know, as my career's gone on. Neil says, how do you rate Prashant Krishna on the back of this series? That doesn't exactly have the 5+ years that it took Ishant, Shami and Umesh to develop in consistent bowlers. Where's he in his development? He might have 5+ years because there are going to be other bowlers around. You know, Ishant had to play, right? Whereas Prashid should be in a better situation. I think he's a very smart young man. I think he works very hard. I worry about his body and his frame. He just needs to learn two lengths. And I think if he learns two lengths with the pace that he bowls and everything else, he'll be fine. But I think he's a bit of a one-length bowler at the moment. And I think if he can just get a length that allows him to take LBWs and bowls and bowl on slightly fresher pitches and then go back to his more natural length back off, I think that's where he's going to be, you know, a handful for anyone. Because he has a high release point and he hits the wicket hard and he can move the ball around and he's clever and he understands things, he should be fine at that point. I think it's very hard to be a one-length bowler anymore. I think we've even seen that with Scott Boland when he went up against Bazball. I think you need multiple tools. What causes drift and dropped? I know these are from rotations on the ball, but what forces are causing the change in direction, both laterally and vertical? I think it's just Magnus, isn't it? I'm not an expert on this, Ben, but I have, you know, unless someone else wants to tell me I'm wrong, I think it's just Magnus effect. And I think swing bowling isn't Magnus, but spin and dip and revolutions and slower balls, I think, is. Just on drift as well. Drift can also be affected by the quality of the ball. It drifts quite a lot in England and there's somewhere else. And that can't just be that those countries have extra revolutions, right? There has to be something to do with quality of the ball, everything there. PJ says, cricket has had some major changes over the years. Overarm bowling, number of balls per over, new formats, fielding rules, bouncer rules, etc. What would be the next major law change in each format that people will still be talking about on podcasts in 100 years' time? Assuming we'll have podcasts in 100 years' time, PJ. The thing we'll be talking about in 100 years' time will be substitutions in cricket. And maybe the other change will be the separation of the two or three formats that are left. I think those are the major ones. And I suppose you can throw in there that international cricket is no longer the main format of cricket, which you could argue is already now. But those are the three, I think. Person says, Pakistan beat West Indies in a sort of home series for West Indies. Is there anything to take away from it? I haven't seen it, Person. So I didn't get a chance to really have a look at it at all. So I have zero takes on that, sadly. Adityan said, spirit of cricket question. Is the unwritten spirit of cricket somehow related to the unwritten constitution in the UK? Uncodified, but people claim it exists. I think the spirit of cricket is a gatekeeping tool for those who understand it, who come from the right kind of backgrounds and want to feel that they are pure or superior to other people. I don't know if that's what the unwritten constitution of the UK is. I don't know enough about that. But I think that's what it is. I think the spirit of cricket becomes a really big thing in the 1950s. And I think Wright Thompson told me this once, which is very, and he was talking about cricket, but in a slightly different way. But he said once that most great country music was actually written by people who lived in cities, who either grew up in the country or came from country stock. So it's like, what's the J.D. Vance book, Hillbilly Elegy? He wasn't a hillbilly, right? And I'm not even saying that he's claiming to be. He's writing about that despite the fact, didn't he grow up in like the suburbs or something, right? Like, yeah, he's trying to take some of the shine of that other thing for himself. But it's also, there is an element of that, of, you know, looking back at that in a sort of poverty porn way, right? And I think that if you look at when spirit of cricket becomes big, it's really fascinating because it really becomes big in the 1950s when England is no longer the sole voice of cricket. When county cricket is no longer the biggest form of cricket, suddenly the spirit of cricket becomes a thing. I'm more than happy, you know, there's obviously the Bluey episode. There is something more about cricket, and I'm more than happy to say that. I don't know if there's more about cricket than there is about tennis or golf or other sports, right? But there's something about that 1950s period that really brings out the spirit of cricket. And for me, it's sanctimonious. It's moral. It's morals-based. It's gatekeeping. And that's where it comes from. Ross Taylor couldn't see at night or when the clouds were in. Eventually, he had to see an eye specialist who would fix his eyesight. In the 2 years before the change, he still averaged more than 50 in international cricket. The top level of batting talent can basically see in the dark. That is who we are talking about in our new book, The Art of Batting. Head over and order your copy today. KG says, do any cricket boards track social media for public sentiment? And even if they do they really care about it anyway? P.S. This question is definitely not about Gambia. Pretty much all Indian cricket fans want Indian fire. I don't know of anyone who does this. I've had conversations before with cricket boards where they were like, it seems really popular at the moment, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no. And they looked shocked. You would think in this modern world, you would have someone whose job it is to make sure. It would shock you to know that there was two cricket media officials one is still in their job and the other one is just leaving their job, and they're cricket media for boards, major boards, you know, top 16 boards. And it shocks me how much they don't even know about cricket media. Like, they're not following the cricket media all that close. There should be someone like an intern giving them briefings on what everyone's writing. And the really good people in cricket boards who work with the media, someone like Danny Rubin or Sips from who works for the ICC or someone like that, probably is keeping an eye on things when they have to, or generally. But a lot of cricket boards don't, and I'm not sure it happens. And so what they end up doing is they get hyper fixated with whoever they do follow. So it might be Crick Info. It might be Michael Vaughan. You know, Trevor Bayliss was obsessed with, you know, what George Dobell would write about him, right? Like, they end up with this incredible relationship. And it's like, I'm not saying don't do that, but it should be deeper than that. So, politicians get like clippings, don't they, of themselves or the news or whatever that is aimed at them. I would have thought cricket boards could pay for that kind of a service. As far as I'm aware, no one does that. Sinoy says, do you think there is still a place for the pitching outside late rule about LBWs? I think the game would be absolutely shit if we took that law away. I've said it so many times. It would be dreadful. So you would have right-arm bowlers bowling around the wicket all the time to leg-side fields, and with no one being able to play offside shots. It would be dreadful cricket. It would be the worst thing. I don't see how it helps cricket at all. It would make it a much more one-dimensional sport for no reason. Rob says, do you think Anderson would have outperformed Wokes in this series in terms of bowling defensively or taking wickets? Yes and yes. That's yes and yes. All right, let's get to the super chats and then off we go on this wagon wheel. Where are we here? Shrikant says, most people watch tests in India. More people watch tests in India than anywhere else. I've had so many conversations about this, and it's so annoying that people... I'm with you. I don't understand why people don't mention this more. Your pundits think of England as the home of test cricket. Why Indian tests are incredibly popular. Is it just that it isn't a spectator sport? I don't know if test cricket scene is just the home. I mean, it's pretty popular in Australia as well. But the crowds make a big difference, don't they, Shrikant? Like, if you're playing... The Oval was sold out, right? Lords can be sold out. Some of those other grounds around the world don't. But it's called the home of Test cricket because Test cricket is still more important in the UK than it is anywhere else. Australia had one-day cricket. India had one-day cricket and then T20 cricket. So that's probably the reason, if you really want to be honest about it. Shub says, I've always had disdain for nationalism for all sorts of reasons, social, political, etc. I'd say sports is the only aspect of my life where being nationalistic for the sake of it is incredibly fun. Yeah, I've got lots of friends that would agree. I like teams. I like cricket. It's just, for me, that's just not how my head works, Shub, if I'm being honest. Anurag says, in your recent podcast with TalkSport, you rated the recent series at number 5 ahead of Border Gavaskar 2021. Surely that series is a lot better and maybe even sneaks into 4 ahead of Border Gavaskar 16-17. No, I don't think so. I don't know. If you talk, we were talking about the entire spectacle and everything else. I think if you're an Indian fan, Border Gavaskar 2021 was big. I don't know if the Australian fans would hold it that high. Whereas a series like this, I mean, English fans and Indian fans have held it really high. And that's kind of what we were looking for. So no, Anurag, I don't think you're right there. There are lots of series that individual fan bases would have very high. But what we're really talking about is a series that neutrals and everyone else got involved with. 2021 was good. 2016, 2017, I think, is one of the big sleepers of all time. But you've got to be shocked, Anurag, that we were just talking for 8 minutes because we were asked a question and we may not have come up with the perfect list. I think people get really, really upset with these things. Oh, you've forgotten this or they said this. And it's like, yeah, if you were talking with your friends and someone suddenly asked you a question, you'd probably say things. It's okay to disagree and it's okay to understand that we may not have made it perfectly. Sid's fault. Anurag says, still can't make sense of New Zealand 3-0 in India. They lose routinely to England. It didn't look like they're a much better team versus India. And Santner bowl slow, which wasn't supposed to do well in India. Most surprising series result ever. You'd have to go back. I think it's certainly up there. I mean, you just asked about the Border Gavaskar 2021 might be up there as well, right? But it's one of the biggest upsets in series. There's actually quite a few big upsets in series history, I think. When it comes down to it. And it wasn't that long before that New Zealand were World Test champions. Obviously, a lot of that team had kind of moved on, but they still had a pretty good structure to them, didn't they, as well? But yeah, I thought that was definitely one of the best, biggest upsets of all time. But a bit like I answered with your last question, you're asking me on the spot to sort of rate, 500 test series off the top of my head? And I don't know, let's say 50 big upsets that we probably had in that, 25 at least. Like, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to answer that correctly. I think, though, me and Bayram did a podcast on it. So if you want to go back and have a look at that, then we probably did, do it much better. Shrikant says, Stat geeks underrate Lily. Experts with subjective opinions, rating much higher. Ben O'Bradman, etc. Perhaps because he was a pioneer? I think with Lily, he was an experience. And watching Lily in Australia... I've talked about this before. I think me and Bayram did a podcast about it recently. Lily was what Sachin was to Australia in some ways, in that he was a cultural touchstone, right? So when you say that Benno and Bradman rate him higher, they're both Australians. I don't think he's quite rated as highly internationally. And a lot of his reputation is probably also built on... as you say, not so much his bowling, but he changed professional cricket. He changed bowling forever. He changed professional cricket forever by signing with Kerry Packer as well. He's probably, before Malcolm Marshall, that first everything bowler. Not quite at Malcolm Marshall's talent, right? But not far off it either. I don't know. When you say stats geeks, you're not really talking about stats geeks there. You're probably talking about average Hawks, right? Who say, well, he averages almost 24. If that's the case, you know, I still think he's great. I probably, if you look at him, he takes, I'm just having a look now, he takes 355 wickets, 230 of those are in Australia. He doesn't tour much, right? Obviously, completely dominates in England, plays briefly in New Zealand, dominates there, plays four tests in Asia, and only one test in the West Indies. He's not as tested as other guys from his era. I think he was still great. There is an element of Javid Mian that his old mate, right, within Lilly, because in the same way that I think if you read my book, I have Mean Dad slightly higher than some other players because of Mean Dad changes modern batting. And I think Lilly even more so changes bowling, right? Biomechanics, fitness, all these little things that he brought in are now just normal, right? And he was doing it while, you know, cleaning offices in Perth, right? So he definitely gets a boost in that. But in that, you know, his record is probably similar to someone like Mahendra Jayawardena's in some ways, right? In that it's a very one-dimensional record in an era where it didn't have to be one-dimensional, right? It's a lot of tests. I'm just having a look now. What's he done? 44 tests at home, 26 away. It's a big disparity between the two. His record isn't that different, but he wasn't as tested in as many places. If you put World Series cricket in, although that's all in Australia, I think he was great in that as well. So I think you can flood his record a little bit more. But also, his career overlaps with Malcolm Marshall, Richard Hadlee, and then straight after him is Glenn McGrath and Pat Cummins and everything else. So is there not an element also of just, there's a bit of Sunil Gavaskar in the regret. Do you know what I mean? Of like Sunil Gavaskar, wow, he's so great. Oh, straight away, oh, now we've got Sachin, right? Oh, now we've got Virat, right? There's an element of that. And then also, it's very similar actually when you think of what happens with Indian cricket. You also have Laxman and Sehwag and Dravid, right? Azharuddin. All these other people, India are creating heaps of Sunil Gavaskars now, right? Even if they're not quite on that level. And a similar thing happens with Australia, right? You know, you get McGrath, you get Gillespie, you get Lee, you then get Johnson, you get a bit of Ryan Harris in there briefly, then you get all the modern day bowlers. So I wonder if all those things play a part. One thing I would say about Lilly is I'm pretty sure that the batting averages were quite high in the games he played. So perhaps there's more extra stuff, but we haven't started the bowling book yet to have a look at it. I still think he does, as I said, a bit like Javid Mian Dad, I think he deserves to be, and Victor Trumper, right? And, you know, some of these other guys deserve to be thought of as higher because of the way they changed the game. They're the reason that some of these other people have great records as well. And I think that's a really important thing when you're looking at great players. But yeah, average Hawks rate Dennis Lilly a little bit lower. I don't think stats geeks do, because if you're really getting into the stats of him, my guess is he's pretty fantastic, right? He looked very good. But yeah, I think he is thought of a lot higher in Australia than everywhere else. And part of that is, if you factor in World Series cricket and how much he played at home, he probably takes like 450 wickets across international cricket, World Series cricket in Australia, and less than 180 everywhere else. So there you go, 27% better than the players in the match he was playing, which is pretty good as well. So yeah, pretty handy player. Would recommend. That's it for us here on the Wagon Wheel. We will be back very soon for more wagons and more wheels on Good Areas Live. Is that what we call it? Yeah, Good Areas Live. That's where we are. Good Areas Live. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.